I believe it was 3 years ago, in doing my annual Palm Sunday Jesus sermon, that I decided to take the humorous route and base my remarks that day on a very delightfully demented book here by Christopher Moore called Lamb, The Gospel According to Biff, Christ's Childhood Pal. It is actually a very well-researched book. It playfully and sort of maniacally at times, and even seriously at other times, plays with the idea of what it might have been like to have grown up having Jesus as a best buddy. And it's told in retrospect from a guy who grew up with him in Nazareth and on through the rest of his life. Now, as is often the case, if I read an author and I really like what he or she has written, I will go back and read just about everything else that author has done. And so I went and did that with Christopher Moore. And I cannot get into his work now except to tell you that it amazes me how someone with such a bizarre and really off-the-rails kind of a mind can produce the kind of good stuff that he does. Well, I finally got my chance to meet Chris Moore a couple of months ago when he was on a tour for his latest book, and he made a stop at the University of Connecticut. Some of you know our son Gordon is there. He is about 5 weeks away from completing his undergraduate education. Hooray, hooray. And he, too, is a Chris Moore fan. Even though his degree is in civil engineering and I'm kind of a theology literary kind of guy, we can talk in common about the stuff that Chris Moore writes. Well, Michelle and I got to the place on the campus where he was appearing a bit early. We were just milling around a little when, lo and behold, Mr. Moore walks up and introduced himself and struck up a conversation with us. He and I had exchanged a few emails, and when I told him I was the Unitarian Universalist minister who'd written him about Lamb, he actually picked up on that. And then later during his presentation, when he got to the question and answer part, somebody asked him a question about this book, and he answered the question, and then he looked over to where I was sitting and points at me and says, "There's a minister over here representing Unitarians who just told me that my book, Lamb, is part of the official canon of the Unitarians." I didn't come close to saying such a thing. But neither he nor I are ones to let a little thing like accuracy get in the way of a good story or a good laugh line. And he wasn't really altogether wrong either, because while we Unitarian Universalists have no official canon, you know, each one of us, I assume I do anyway, find things that become part of kind of our personal scripture, and this book of his has become a part of my personal scripture. Well, I just had to tell you that story. It's got nothing to do with the rest of this sermon. Which will mostly deal with Thomas Jefferson's take on the life and ministry of Jesus of Nazareth, except for this one connection. Whoever Jesus was, and whatever he may have said and done, he continues to be, over a couple of millennia now, a person of fascination to an amazingly wide range of people. From a scholarly and erudite political and moral philosopher and politician like Thomas Jefferson, to a guy like Christopher Moore, whose last two novels are about vampires who operate on the streets and below the streets of San Francisco. My sermon title is also a straight steal from Mr. Jefferson. Beginning around the year 2003, he began work on a book which he called The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth. Today, that book is generally referred to as the Jefferson Bible, although Jefferson wasn't so pretentious as to give it that name himself. Now, the version that I'm using, that I've got here, was actually published by our own denominations, Beacon Press. It is given a rather lengthy editorial introduction by the Reverend Forrest Church of the Unitarian Church of All Souls in New York City. Forrest did his doctoral thesis on the Jefferson Bible when he was a student at Harvard. Well, Jefferson's efforts to do this grew out of some conversations and correspondence he had with people. People like Joseph Priestley, whom I did a sermon on here last fall, and John Adams, who preceded him in the presidency, and Benjamin Rush, and Benjamin Franklin. In other words, a lot of those people whom we now enshrine in the pantheon of those we call the founding fathers, as indeed they were. These gentlemen, the ones I just mentioned, some others as well as Jefferson, they were primarily deists and rationalists. They called themselves practical Christians, meaning they thought to extract what they consider to be the practical human lessons and moral lessons contained in the life and teachings of Jesus, while disavowing the idea of Jesus as a divine Savior who had to die to save us from a state of original sin. You might want to bear that in mind next time someone tries to tell you that our country was founded by evangelical Christians. It is simply not true. In fact, as I mused a little on Jefferson's life and religion, these thoughts went through my head. Remember, I said Jefferson was a deist, meaning he did not believe in a personal God. And although he was not a member of a Unitarian church, since there were none in his vicinity near Monticello, down there in Charlottesville, Virginia, he was, as some of his writings demonstrate, a self-proclaimed Unitarian, and he rejected the divinity of Jesus. All of which leads me to conclude that given our current social, cultural, religious, and political climate, were Mr. Jefferson to run for president in 2008, he wouldn't have a proverbial snowball's chance in hell of getting elected. I seriously doubt he would even carry his own state of Virginia. Moving right along. The thing that intrigues me the most about the Jefferson Bible, though, is not the content itself, which is basically what Jefferson chose to leave in of the four New Testament Gospels. He went through and he extracted what he thought were all references to Jesus' divinity, miracles such as that, and just left the teachings and some of the incidents from his life there. But what really fascinates me about that is that Jefferson even made the effort to do it, to compile it. What was it that drove him to devote all the time that he did to this project if he didn't accept the way in which Jesus came to be portrayed by the first and second century Christian church? Well, I'm going to shut myself off here. Sorry, Mike, I'll go with this one. We'll switch it back. There we go. Well, what drove him was that very thing. What drove him was his conviction that there was a person behind all the dogmatic obfuscation who was worth seeking and discovering and emulating. And a letter that Jefferson wrote to a friend of his while he was in the process of doing his Jefferson Bible bears this out. And at first he really gets downright nasty with the gospel writers. Here are his words. We find in the writings of Jesus' biographers a groundwork of vulgar ignorance, of things impossible, of superstitions, fanaticisms, and fabrications. Gee, you know, those are just not very nice things to be saying about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Especially for the third president of the United States. Going back to what I just said a moment ago, that's the kind of soundbite today that would instantly sink a political career before it ever got off the ball. In fact, taking a little flight of fantasy here, I can just imagine Fox News' Sean Hannity or John Gibson having an out-and-out field day self-righteously grilling Jefferson on that remark. They do it, of course, in a fair and balanced way, but but Jefferson, he's not finished with that. That's only the prelude. There is a flip side to what he said. He goes on to say, intermixed with these being all the, what he called superstitions and fabrications, intermixed with these are precepts of the highest morality and benevolence, sanctioned by a life of humility, innocence, simplicity of manners, neglect of riches, absence of worldly ambitions and honors, with an eloquence that has not been surpassed. Kind of made up for all that stuff about, you know, dissing the gospel writers. Jefferson believed then that there was this ideal life that could be found and lifted up and learned from if one could just dig it out. And he felt that the recovery of this supreme human ideal, which he felt Jesus to be, and the person whom he believed epitomized it, was clearly worth the effort he put into assembling the life and morals of Jesus of Nazareth. Well, it was a noble effort on Jefferson's part, and I would commend his work to anyone, clear across the religious spectrum, conservative to liberal, as it does demonstrate, he does a good job of demonstrating a real core of wisdom that was at the heart of Jesus' teachings and at the life he's portrayed as living. That said, Jefferson was off base in a couple of ways. One was that the New Testament gospel writers, whoever they may have been, were really not biographers of Jesus, as Jefferson calls them. Not biographers, that is to say, in the way we understand biography today. For you see, the Gospels are really theological tracts. And the four that made it into the New Testament, as we're beginning to learn, are only our four of who knows how many others that were out there offering various kinds of theological takes on who Jesus was. So you had these four Gospels written in the first and second century to offer a certain kind of religious and theological interpretation of the life of someone named Jesus, and they were written really to substantiate a theological conclusion that had already been reached, and to substantiate that conclusion. They weren't written as a strict biography. And while I believe they were based on an actual historical figure, I do believe that, which is to say I don't believe the first century church just made Jesus up out of whole cloth, it's not a figure we can actually point to in the way that we can point to someone like, well, say, Thomas Jefferson. So this idea Jefferson had, that if I could just get rid of all that first century superstition and worldview, I'll find the real living, breathing Jesus, was something of an oversimplification on his part. Because the Jesus story is so intertwined with the worldview of that day that it just doesn't break out all that cleanly. And in a way, what Jefferson was doing was what a lot of people who have delved into the life of Jesus do, sort of take your stance, the way you see the world, and you reflect it back onto him. Jefferson was taking his 18th century Enlightenment ideals and his codes of morality, which, as we've come to find out, he didn't always do that good a job of living up to himself, but he took his 18th century Enlightenment ideals and codes of morality and tried to place their ultimate source and sanction in the life and morals of Jesus of Nazareth. So I believe then that Jefferson's attraction to the life of Jesus goes well beyond the particulars of his life, of Jesus' life that Jefferson was trying to pull out of it. And the same goes for Christopher Moore, as well as for anyone else, myself certainly included, who tries to delve in to this very enigmatic life. For what we are all really seeking, I feel, is something that will call us to our better, even our best human selves. For except for those few folk, and I believe it's only a few, except for those few folk who live a totally self-indulgent and completely me-centered life, most of us look beyond ourselves for something we believe will help us live, the kinds of lives we feel we're most capable of living and most ideally want to live. And while musing on abstract ideals like love and justice and compassion and peace and generosity and humility and all the like are fine, stories about people who strove to live out their lives in accordance with these ideals are far more attractive and are far more compelling and are much easier to relate to than simply abstract words and concepts. I think that's why the Jesus story has maintained its attraction and its significance over the centuries. The reason I say the Jesus story is so captivating and remains so captivating is because it is a story of who we, as human beings, might yet be. It's not the only story out there about who we, as human beings, might yet be, but it's one of those genre of stories. And the very fact that in this particular story, the human being at the heart of that story will be forever hidden behind a veil of legend and myth is really what makes the story all the more intriguing. Because it demands that we have to look at it and find what we need the most in it, as it allows us to do. I will say that however one reads this story, one clear and unmistakable element to it is a portrayal of Jesus as someone who deliberately chose to put him outside the mainstream of his society So he could then look back and critique that society, point to the errors of its way, and call its members to greater levels of love and mercy and justice. His critiques were personal critiques of the people he worked with as well, because he taught that transformation must take place on a personal level in order to then reach beyond the personal. Some of his sayings, as you look at them, have a kind of almost Zen Buddhist-like quality to them. He liked to teach by posing paradoxes, like the need to lose one's life in order to find it. Like saying that the first shall be last and the last first. By maintaining that true wealth and power is found in the renunciation of wealth and power and the like. The Jesus story is also that of someone who was well-educated by the standards of his day, but who chose primarily to identify with the outcasts of his society, even as those who were out on the margins, in a manner similar to what the Buddha did by rejecting his background of privilege and identifying with the poor of his time. And in a way, Jesus did take the stance of a revolutionary who challenged the established order in a number of ways, which is why, as his story is told, he got himself executed, which is the event that is commemorated in Christian churches this week. We'll wrap up on this. In his book, Being Liberal in an Illiberal Age, the Reverend Jack Mendelson, now in retirement, offers this observation. The Jesus portrayed in the Gospels is an elusive figure. What we really seem to mean when we say the Spirit of Jesus is the answer to our problems is that we would try to the best of our ability to live by the moral precepts we choose to identify with Jesus. Many of my co-religionists identify with the moral goals Jesus represented to them, namely compassion, unselfishness, self-sacrifice, faithfulness, and goodwill. No one should be upset if I suggest that the admirable goals represented by this chosen idealization of Jesus can be duplicated in all of the world's great religions. And then Jack goes on to say, to me, the important thing about Jesus is not that he was just human, but that the human race is capable of producing him. And not just him alone, but others like him. And not only in ancient times, but now. I take a certain amount of hope from those last few words of Jack Mendelson's. Namely, that we human beings, even though we don't always live up to who we can be, that we human beings are at least capable of conceiving someone who lived the kind of life that Jesus is portrayed as living. The kind of life Jefferson and so many others tried to find. So to end on a personal note, while the person and figure of Jesus is no longer central to my overall religious and spiritual grounding as it was when I was growing up, I do find in his life an image of what human beings and who I as a human being are yet capable of being and becoming. I feel his story is also part of a greater story of human beings striving after their most authentic human selves, which is why I believe his story is one for both humanists and theists alike, and deists like Jefferson as well. I believe that for the sake of our own humanity, it is a story that we should not lose. So let's sing together hymn number 276.